Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 26. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we get started, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. A huge thank you to Andy, Joanna, Christina, Sharon, Jenny and Julie. Thank you so much, Noelle, Dawn, Daniel, Leslie, Katie, Jenny G and Sarah. A big thank you to Shah, Beth, Carol, Caroline, Sally, Haynes, Stephanie, Stacey, Callan, Marcus, Lauren and Sarah. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family before the end of March, and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. This month's prize is a $50 gift card to ColouringTudorHistory.com, home to Colouring History, Tudor Queens and Consorts, a lavishly illustrated colouring book for adults, and a range of fabulous Tudor-inspired gifts designed and illustrated by the very talented Catherine Holman. Thank you, Catherine, for donating this wonderful gift. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Catherine Carey and Jane Boleyn is Adrian Dillard. Adrian is a graduate with a Bachelor of Arts in Liberal Studies with emphasis in history from Montana State University, Northern. She has been an eager student of history for most of her life and has completed in-depth research on the American Revolutionary Wartime period in American history and the history and sinking of the Titanic. Her senior university capstone paper was on the discrepancies in passenger lists on the ill-fated liner, and Adrian was able to work with Encyclopaedia Titanica for much of her research on that subject. Her previous works include best-selling novel Corotto, a novel of Catherine Carey, and Catherine Carey in a Nutshell for Made Global's History in a Nutshell series. Her newest novel, The Raven's Widow, was released in February 2017. When she isn't writing, Adrian works as an administrative assistant in the financial services industry and enjoys spending time with her husband Kyle and son Logan at their home in the Pacific Northwest. My conversation with Adrian straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Adrian. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I would absolutely love it if you could just introduce yourself to our listeners and tell all of us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a married mom to one.
Lovely.
My son Logan is 9 and he is such a little personality. I just love him.
Oh, gorgeous.
He's actually named after Wolverine.
All right, yes.
So he's kind of our own little superhero. I grew up in Montana, which is a couple of states over from where I live now. I grew up in a rural area. My father and stepmother still live there, and they are wheat farmers.
Right, okay.
So I came from kind of that rural background. I went to college in Montana and graduated with my bachelor's in liberal studies, which is kind of a more general degree, which was really nice because it gave me a really good grounding in the humanities. And I got to focus on three different areas, which were history, political science, and economics,
Lovely.
which is nice because they all kind of relate to each other.
They do, yes, exactly.
Yeah. And so I moved out here to Oregon after graduating. So I'm right on the west coast of the US in the Pacific Northwest. And I write in my spare time, but by day I have a full-time job. I
Wow,
work
gosh.
for yeah, I work for an investment company, and I am an administrative assistant to a financial advisor. And actually, this last year, I took all my tests to become a financial advisor myself.
Oh, fantastic. Wonderful.
Yeah, but I just don't feel qualified to give people investment advice. I am technically qualified, but I don't feel, like I am. So I like to be in the background and assist my advisor, and then, it gives me more time to write. So,
Exactly. That's wonderful. And what sparked your interest in the tutors?
well, usually when I get asked this question, I kind of give a canned response because I don't know what the reaction will be when I tell people how I really got interested. So this is a first.
Come on, you can do it. You can do it. We're a friendly lot here on Talking Tutors.
Oh, good. Well, so I always was interested in history growing up. I was really interested in the Revolutionary War and World War II. And then in college, I was interested in, the Edwardian period. And I wrote about Titanic for my capstone paper.
Oh,
And
fantastic. I love the story of the Titanic. I'm totally
oh,
intrigued by it. Yep.
yes, it is. I mean, it's just, I mean, such an interesting story, and so sad.
Yes.
So I never really knew anything about the Tudors.
Right.
And around in 2008, my stepdad passed away. And so we were trying to kind of, my mom was struggling and we were trying to get her out of the house. And I took her to go see the Other Boleyn Girl.
Right, okay, yep.
Yeah. And so as I was watching it, I just kept thinking, like, I don't know, something about it just didn't sit right with me. Like it was missing something or the story wasn't right. But, I just kind of didn't really think much about it. And
Right.
then about another year later, I had been struggling with a health issue, and I had been going to chiropractor, acupuncturist, physical therapist, like all these people. And somebody suggested me I go see a hypnotherapist.
Right, okay.
So I went to go see a hypnotherapist, and while I was under, I just started telling this really elaborate story about this woman who is a sister to the queen, and
Wow.
she didn't know, and she was going, she was coming home from exile, and she was gonna go serve her sister who didn't know she was her sister. And I mean, it was just this really like detailed story. And of course, when I came out of it, the therapist was really excited.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Gosh.
Yeah, so she wrote everything down, and I thought, well, this is really interesting because I mean, I didn't know, and I still don't know, like how I feel about that experience, like what it was or why I had it. But of course, I went to Google and discovered Katherine Carey. You know, I just started Googling what information I had, right. and the closest that came was Katherine. And, you know, I was talking to my husband about it, and he was like, well, why don't you write a story? Like, maybe this is, you know, a story that you're meant to tell. And, of course, I kind of laughed at him. Like, I'm not a writer. And eventually, I just kind of started writing it as a way to kind of work through it a little bit.
Right, like, okay, yeah.
Yeah. So that was how Corrado came to be.
That's fascinating. What an amazing story. I'm really interested in those kinds of stories of past life regressions and all of that. So I'll have to talk to you more about that after, I think. Was a perfect segue, actually, into my next question, because I was going to say that you've written two wonderful Tudor novels, and I've seen so many positive, you know, glowing reviews about your work. So you mentioned Colorado, a novel of Katherine Carey, and there's also The Raven's Widow, a novel of Jane Boleyn. Could you tell us a little bit about these books? And I suppose we've sort of heard what inspired you to write the novel of Katherine Carey, but I'm especially interested in what inspired you to write about Jane Boleyn.
Well, shortly after Corrado came out, I was kind of in the middle of trying to decide if I wanted to write more, because Corrado was kind of like a personal, I actually didn't even expect anybody to even read the book. I never expected it to be published, you know, and so I was really kind of trying to decide whether it was something I wanted to pursue more. And I had a hysterectomy.
Right, okay.
And this was in like January, end of January, early February, and I was home recuperating. Mm-hmm. And that's about the time that people were posting on social media about the execution of Katherine Howard and Jane Boleyn. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I was, of course, at home since I was recuperating, spending a lot of time on social media.
Yes.
And so I just, as I was seeing these posts, I just started thinking about, you know, how I felt about the fact that I wouldn't have any more children.
Mm.
And thinking about what it must have been like for somebody like Jane, you know, living in a time where women were really expected to be having children, providing heirs, you know, and obviously with the idea of Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn and their failure to provide what Henry VIII termed as heirs, even though obviously they had two beautiful children.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, and just thinking about Jane and how she would have felt. And, you know, so I picked up Julia Fox's biography again. Yes. I had read it before, but I picked it up again and I started reading it with a different perspective. And, you know, I just really kind of, as I was reading it, I also started to see some traits in Jane that I also had seen in my mom, you know, a widow who had, you know, lost her husband in a very traumatic event, you know, and just kind of the way they dealt with their grief. And I just saw a lot of that, you know, a lot of commonality in their story. And I really just kind of felt that Jane had just kind of gotten a bum rap.
Exactly. All right. Well, thank you so much for being so open and for sharing, you know, that very personal story. I can see why your book has been so successful, because I'm a firm believer in the fact that when we do things, you know, with a sort of end goal to make money or to be successful, things don't often work out. But when we come from a place, obviously, like you have, of personal healing and connection, I think the universe kind of surprises us with the success that we can have. So that's a fantastic story. Thank you. Now, over the years, there have been some questions raised about the paternity of Mary Boleyn's children, Catherine and Henry Carey. Now, the official Tudor line is that they're the children of Mary Boleyn and her first husband, William Carey. However, at the time of their birth circa 1524 and 1526 respectively, their mother was Henry VIII's mistress, so that nothing's ever straightforward when it comes to Tudor history. I would love to hear what you think And, you know, rumors aside, what do the sources actually tell us about their paternity?
Yes, nothing is ever as straightforward as it seems, for sure. So to answer your question, I do feel that Catherine, not necessarily Henry, but I do feel that Catherine was Henry VIII's daughter. You know, that's mostly because I research like a historian, but I think like a novelist.
Right, yeah.
I like, you know, sometimes you kind of have to go with your gut instinct and kind of read between the lines, because the official record is not, you know, it never tells us, you know, the whole story. And so, you know, obviously, I think the resemblance, you know, if you look at that portrait of Catherine Carey, she looks so much like Henry. You know, and I know that the Tudors and the Boleyns are, you know, related from way back down the line. But to look at her picture, it looks so much like Henry VIII. You know, and there's not really much in the sources that tell us for sure.
Right.
You know, there are grants to William Carey. But that doesn't really tell us that much, because, you know, there were many men at court who were given grants. And, you know, William Carey was a trusted courtier. He served Henry well. You know, he could have been given those just because the king was generous also. So, you know, and, you know, obviously Henry never did claim them as his children. And, you know, I mean, there was really, first of all, no reason for him to, and he really couldn't, because the Tudor law at the time, I mean, even if they were his children, the law at the time was that the, you know, if the woman was married, then her husband was the lawful, you know, father.
Yeah,
so he couldn't have claimed them anyways. But I think I think that the strongest evidence was Catherine's appointment to Anne of Cleves' household. Those maid of honor positions were very competitive. And generally, you know, if it wasn't you weren't a child of the aristocracy, you had somebody who kind of spoke for you. Helped to get you into those positions. And Catherine really didn't have anybody to do that for her. You know, the Boleyns were kind of in disgrace. You know, her mother had never really been welcomed back at court since her banishment in 1504, I think. You know, and Thomas Boleyn had died by this point. And, you know, it's possible that the Duke of Norfolk might have spoke for her, but I think it's probably unlikely. You know, just getting Catherine Howard into position there, and, you know, I think her getting into the household is a good thing. And also, she was extremely close to Queen Elizabeth. Elizabeth was just inconsolable after her death. Catherine was really seen as very close to Queen Elizabeth, and she, you know, paid for this really elaborate funeral. And in fact, the Dean of Westminster and the heralds argued over her hearse because it was so sumptuous.
Oh dear, funny. All right, well, Catherine, you've touched on this a little. She was, of course, too young to serve her aunt, Queen Anne Boleyn, or Anne's successor, Jane Seymour, but she did serve as a maid of honour to Anne of Cleves, as you've mentioned, and Catherine Howard, and would eventually become one of Elizabeth's favourites. Could you talk to us a little bit more about Catherine's career at court?
Yeah, so she's first recorded in the Chronicle of Calais as being one of the maids to greet Anne of Cleves when she arrived in 1540. We don't know if she came from Hever or another Boleyn property, but it's possible she actually came over from Calais with her stepfather.
Right.
So she became pregnant very soon after her marriage, which happened that spring. So it was in April of 1540. Mm-hmm. So she kind of disappears from the records a little bit, you know, because she was at home having lots of children.
Yeah.
And so she did not serve during Edward's time because, you know, obviously he was still in the minority and he wasn't married. Yes, so there was really no reason for her to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And then during Mary's time, you know, her and her husband at some point did go abroad in exile, because they were very vocal Protestants.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so she wasn't at court during Mary's time. And then, you know, when Elizabeth came to the throne, she was immediately appointed chief lady of the Privy Chamber. Mm. And she was keeper of the Queen's jewels.
Wow. Very privileged positions, both of those, obviously.
Yes. Yes. Mm. Extremely privileged. And she was responsible for a lot of the gifts that Elizabeth received. She actually particularly had charge of a chained monk.
Oh, right. The Tudors, they give such fabulous gifts, don't they?
They do. And then after Cat Ashley died, she was appointed chief lady of the bedchamber.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that role, she would have slept in the queen's chamber. You know, that was probably one of the most privileged positions that you could be in.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah, so she obviously had access to the queen, and I guess access is the key thing, isn't it, in the Tudor times. If you have access, you have power as well. So very interesting.
Absolutely. Now
you mentioned her marriage in the spring of 1540. She married Sir Francis Knowles, is that right?
That's correct.
And I believe they had 14 children. So how did this match come about?
Well, we don't really know.
Right.
you know, so many of the Tudor people, we really don't know.
I know, it's tricky, isn't it? So frustrating at times. You just, the gaps that are missing. Yeah,
I know. And aristocratic marriages at the time were generally, you know, a match made by the parents, usually arranged. There were love matches. And, you know, it's often thought that theirs was a love match because mm-hmm. they just had the most loving relationship.
Oh, that's so wonderful to hear, isn't it? It's not that often that you hear that.
It really is. I call it, you know, one of the great Tudor love matches because they were just so devoted to each other. Based upon the Latin dictionary, Sir Francis Knowles had a Latin dictionary that he kept the names of all of his children's births in.
Right. Okay. Fabulous.
Yeah. And in some of them, he had listed like the time of day that they born. Yeah. And so he was probably there, which is a little unusual.
That is unusual. Yeah.
Yeah. But he wrote these letters, towards the end of Catherine's life. He was, you know, he had been sent to take kind of custody of, Mary, Queen of Scots.
Right,
when
yes.
she came into England
mm-hmm.
and he went to go question her and kind of feel her out a little bit for Elizabeth.
Right.
And he just absolutely hated it because he was away from his wife. He was away from court. And he would just send these letters back. And they're really like desperate letters. And there's a point where he makes this comment about how the messengers are mad at him because he just keeps sending letters.
That's so funny. I never heard of that before. So does he's out of curiosity, I think you said it was a dictionary that he was, is that right?
Yeah.
Does that survive?
It does.
Oh,
it
wow.
does. Yeah. And it's at the Bodleian Library.
Oh, fantastic. That's so cool. Yeah. I love learning about the new artifacts that are, you know, well, they're not new artifacts, but the artifacts that are still out there. That's just, you know, because that brings them so much closer. As you say, they've suddenly become.
It really does.
Yeah. They become human. Yeah. And I can imagine him sort of sitting there and writing, noting those things down. And that's fabulous. I love those little snapshots of the really human side of these people that lived, you know, 500 years ago. That's fantastic.
It really is amazing. And, you know, there was so much debate over how many children they had and who was born first.
Oh, because, 14 children, that's a lot.
Yeah. Well, and their daughter, Lettice was, you know, often thought to be the eldest, you know, because she took precedence over, you know, the rest of the children. And actually, she was the third. You know, she just took precedence because she was a countess twice over.
I see. Yeah, so, goodness.
Yeah, so kind of solved that debate.
All right. Thank you. That was wonderful. Now, I'd really now love to talk about Jane Boleyn, whom Julia Fox, which is one of her biographers, as you've mentioned, refers to as the pariah of Tudor history. So could you talk to us about Jane's background and how she came to find herself at court married to George Boleyn and part of one of the most sort of powerful royal circles of the time?
So Jane grew up in Essex, and she lived at Great Hallingbury with her. Her father was Henry Parker, Lord Morley. And actually, Lord Morley was brought up in the household of Lady Margaret Beaufort. And his stepfather was Sir Edward Howard, who is an uncle to Anne Boleyn. Mm-hmm. So they had kind of these connections to the Boleyn family that way. She's first recorded at court during the Chateau Vert pageant on Shrove Tuesday in 1522. So as we know, Mary played kindness and Anne played perseverance.
Yes, amazing, absolutely amazing. Just, yes. You know, thinking with hindsight about, I won't divert the conversation, but just quickly thinking in hindsight about Anne's perseverance title is quite just mind-boggling, isn't it?
It really is. It really is.
Yeah. Sorry, continue. So, I interrupted you.
No, not at all. I mean, that's absolutely true. And so Jane was there too, and she played Constancy.
Right. Okay.
Which she's kind of the constant pariah.
That's just interesting too, isn't it? Because she's kind of there for quite a long time.
Yes. Yes. But she was possibly at the Field of Cloth of Gold meeting. Mm-hmm. There is a note in there that a Mistress Parker was in the household of Catherine of Aragon there. Mm-hmm. And so she could have been at court as early as 1520.
So
the match with George came about in the mid-1520s, and you know, he was an excellent choice for her. They were close to the same age. Mm-hmm. The Boleyns held neighboring lands in Essex, and the Boleyns were a family that was on the rise.
Absolutely.
You know, even before Anne came to the attention of the king.
That's exactly right, and I think that's an important note to make, and I'm so very glad that Lauren Mackay, Dr. Mackay, has written a book and it really shows how the Boleyns, Thomas Boleyn, was rising, and it wasn't to do with Anne. So, you know, that was happening beforehand. Of course, that helped, obviously. But but they were a family on the rise, as you say, prior to Henry's eyes, you know, deciding that he wanted Anne. So that's a really good point to make.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, they were a family that it was good to be connected to. And more importantly, the Boleyns were a family that treasured knowledge and adopted humanist ideals, which is something that Lord Morley really valued.
Right.
You know, and in fact, he's really well known for being, you know, he transcribed a lot of works for the king and for Thomas Cromwell. Right. He's a very well-known scholar. You know, and actually both Thomas and Henry held links to Erasmus.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so it was kind of like a match made in heaven.
It was, but that's not how we hear of it now.
Exactly.
Now, again, perfect segue to my next question. So popular history would have us believe, of course, that Jane and George's marriage was utterly miserable. You know, we're often presented with this kind of sour-faced and vindictive Jane, who's jealous of her husband's relationship with his sister Anne, and basically hates her husband and hates her sister-in-law. Do we know where this view originated, and does it bear any resemblance to the truth?
Well, it probably originated with George Cavendish, who, as we know, was a servant to Cardinal Wolsey. He was no fan of the Boleyns.
No.
You know, he really kind of blamed them for Wolsey's downfall. And additionally, you know, he was a very devoted Catholic who you know was not a fan of the Protestants faction at court. So when he wrote his biography on Wolsey, he wrote a poem called Metrical Visions. And this has often very much been used to kind of paint this picture of Jane. Right. But the thing about it is that Metrical Visions was a poem, you know?
Yeah.
Very much allegorical. It's like, it's written as like a tragedy with characters like Dame Fortune. Mm-hmm. It's like a morality play, really.
Yep.
And so if you look at it as a whole, you know, it lists out the men who were executed with Anne, and, you know, George Boleyn died of vanity. Norris died of ambition and wealth. Mm-hmm. Weston died of unchecked lust.
Right.
He calls him West the Wanton.
Oh, really? Oh, gosh.
Yes.
Oh, dear.
So, you know, it's not meant to be taken as this yep. kind of actual, you know, recreation of what happened.
Of what happened, yeah.
But it has been used as that sort of source because, you know, obviously Cavendish lived at that time, but he's not a reliable witness. And I mean, just like today, we can't take a poem as like proof of,
exactly.
you know, it's supposed to be artistic. So, you know, people like George Wyatt and Bishop Burnet and Lord Herbert of Shrewsbury kind of drew on this. And actually something that I just learned is that George Wyatt's Life of Anne Boleyn, it's usually thought that he wrote that because of the Boleyn connections to the Wyatt family. Mm. But actually, he wrote that at the instigation of Elizabeth's Archbishop of Canterbury.
Oh, right. Okay. Oh.
Yeah, so I guess it was written in reaction to the Catholic propaganda, blamed Anne for the Reformation and attacked the new church by, you know, saying that there was no personal morals. And so I think that, you know, his using Jane has kind of this villainous in it. Mm. It kind of draws out of her, you know, relationship with Catherine Howard.
Yes.
You know. And so, obviously, she must have been a horrible person. So.
That's right. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. So we have this, as a bit of a summary, there's a kind of 16th century poem, and then this has been perpetuated right. throughout the centuries by various authors and other people. So it's a bit like, I just love the historian John Guy, I think it was him that said that these things are like those, you know, the trick birthday candles that you try and blow out but they keep reigniting. You know, he kind of compares these, how can I call them, myths or stories in Tudor history to those trick candles that you try, you know, we all try our best to extinguish and somehow they end up lit again. So I really like that imagery that he uses about that. Now, Adrian, we're going to move into highly controversial territory here. I'm just warning you, just a pre-warning. So if you, and I'm sure you're so aware of this, having researched and written about Jane, if you mention Jane's name on social media, there, you know, there's just crowds of people ready to argue and to tell you that she played a prominent role in the downfall of her husband and sister-in-law in April, May 1536. And that not only did she play a prominent role, but that she provided Thomas Cromwell with the evidence needed to accuse Anne and George of incest. I'd love to know what you uncovered during your research.
Oh, yeah. I kind of try to stay off of social media when they kind of launch into that.
I know. And so, it's hard.
I always keep getting dragged into the conversation, but, you know, we keep trying to blow out those candles.
Exactly. It's the candle imagery again. We keep trying. I know.
Yes. So actually, there was an Italian historian and satirist called Gregorio Leti, and he circulated a confession professed to be given by Jane on the scaffold, saying that she falsely accused George and Anne of an incestuous relationship. You know, it was actually a forgery, and he was kind of known for that and for inventing sources. But somehow it kind of fell into the accepted belief of Jane, you know, but there was an eyewitness, Otwell Johnson, who did actually see Jane's execution and heard her scaffold speech. And it was your basic Tudor boilerplate confession on the scaffold, you know, confessing her sins, giving her soul over to God, and ironically praying for the king.
Yes, we always need to pray for the king if we're on the scaffold. Yep.
Exactly. So, you know, there is absolutely no contemporary record of Jane's involvement. And in fact, several times accusers are mentioned. Bridget Wingfield, Nan Cobham, Lady Worcester, but Jane is never mentioned.
That's amazing, isn't it? It really just amazes me that there is not one, as you've said, not one scrap of contemporary evidence that we've seen as of yet. And if anyone's seen one, you know, please connect with us. But she's always blamed for this. And it shows the power. And I have absolutely nothing against historical fiction and creative license, but it does show the power of really good writing, doesn't it? Really good fictional writing that kind of gets, I suppose, absorbed into popular culture and people just perpetuate it without even really meaning it. It just kind of happens, doesn't it, over the centuries. That's, it's amazing. Poor Jane having been blamed for something like that. But anyway,
look. I know. I feel so bad for her.
I do. I feel bad for her too, to be honest. Now, of course, people that kind of have this view of Jane in their head, then knowing her involvement with Catherine Howard kind of makes it all the more that you're like, yeah, see what I mean? She was not a good person. So Jane Boleyn later served Henry VIII's fifth wife, Catherine Howard. And again, somehow she ends up embroiled in another almighty scandal that eventually saw her sent to the scaffold. Could you talk us through Jane's involvement in this completely dramatic event?
Absolutely. You know, by the time Catherine Howard becomes queen, Jane was one of the more senior members of the queen's household. She had probably served in that, you know, particular area the longest. And so at some point, Catherine ordered Jane to deliver a trinket or a message to Culpeper, and Jane complied, as I think most any of us would have, you know, when our boss tells us to do something. Generally we do that. You know, and then somehow the things just kind of spiraled out of control. And so Catherine would send messages to Culpeper to come when Lady Rochford was with her, you know, and she would kind of help her to find spots to meet while they were on the Northern Progress.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, why she got involved, we really don't know. We can only kind of guess. You know, maybe she just helped once, and it just kind of, once she figured she did it, she had to continue to do so. And it's possible maybe she considered going to tell somebody. But you know, that puts her in an awful position because, you know, Henry was very much in love, or at least lust, with Catherine Howard. And, you know, if somebody would have gone to him and said, hey, this is what your wife is doing, who would have believed her?
Well, that is what he does in the end when he finally discovers it. He does question it and he does order a full investigation. So he's not just believing what's told to him straight away. So, you're right, exactly.
Yeah, and you know, I think Jane was probably a little isolated at this point. You know, she didn't, she was still, you know, not married. She didn't have, you know, anybody in her personal relationships to kind of help her. And, you know, in the past she had gone to Thomas Cromwell. He wasn't around by this point, so he couldn't step in to help her. You know, and it doesn't seem like she was particularly well liked by, you know, the younger girls who were serving Catherine. You know, and it seemed really kind of like a mean girls club, you know. And if you read the interrogations, this was obviously an open secret in Catherine's household. They all kind of knew about it, but yet they all kind of turned the finger towards Jane. You know, so she kind of took the fall for everybody. You know, she was the one who was actually helping Catherine, but they all really kind of knew about it. So it's really kind of interesting how she was the only maid who was punished, even though the rest of them were still also kind of guilty by association.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking that Henry changed the law in order to be able to have her executed? So it feels it feels like there was something kind of personal there. I don't know exactly what, but to me, it seems he wanted to bring her down, and that was the end of the story. Do you have any comment on that? Like, why you think he went to such extents to have her executed?
In Fox's book, she talks about how Jane still dressed, in her mourning clothes.
Right. Okay.
And so she publicly mourned for the death of her husband, who was killed as a traitor.
Wow.
You know,
that's
which
amazing.
Was really
I hadn't heard that. That's a really powerful image. And again, to the people that think that she brought George down and Anne, or helped to bring George.
Right.
You know, that doesn't really make sense, does it? It doesn't sit right, really.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And, so she maybe didn't quite toe the line on, Anne and George's death.
Mm.
And it's possible that this was kind of like his way of, kind of just putting an end to the whole Boleyn connection there. So.
Yeah, right. So she may have served as a kind of reminder to the king, which he didn't want reminding of, really, that period of history. It's also, I love to think of everything that Jane saw, like all the people that she saw come and go. It's so incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
Gosh.
It really is.
All right. Well,
I would love to have a conversation with her.
Oh, wouldn't that be? Oh my goodness. Yeah, I know. I love time. Talk to me about time travel, and I'm there. I'm excited. I'm ready to go. So.
Yes.
Now, there are many public misconceptions, as we've been discussing, about Jane Boleyn. In your opinion, what do you think is one of the most sort of persistent ones?
I think the idea that she was just this kind of troublemaker who loved gossip and kind of always had her nose in everybody's business. Even the people who kind of are what historians call Jane apologists say, she was addicted to court life and she was, she just was this, she couldn't help herself. She had to get involved. And, I personally don't think that's true. I don't think that the sources really bear that out. But even if she was, like, why does that have to kind of consign her to karmic hell?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, who doesn't love a piece of gossip? I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
And this idea that she was addicted to court life, what else was there for her at this point? She was a widow. She was, she still retained her title. She had to keep up that household. She was required to. Mm-hmm. And the only place where she'd be able to make that sort of an income in order to do that was to go to court. So, I think that you really just kind of had to swallow your pride and just go and make the best of it.
Yeah, I feel like she's similar to Thomas Boleyn, who, of course, has been so harshly judged because he did have to return to court at some point and had to play a part. But, of course, that was the life they were in. So there was no real easy escape from that, was there? And I think Jane's been judged for the same thing. Like, she returned as well and served other people and continued playing that sort of role. But that was so intertwined with her identity, as you've said. What else, she didn't have other things at the time. So it's fascinating. It really is fascinating how people are constructed over the centuries. It just amazes me. It's so linked to what of course, all the inbuilt ideas about what women should be and what women should be doing and, really fascinating stuff. I love it. Thank you so much. Now, Adrian, where can listeners find out more about you, like you and your books and your work?
Well, they can find my books pretty much on any, Amazon, Book Depository, any place where, you can buy books. And then I have a website, which is adrian-dillard.com.
Excellent.
So somebody already had adriandillard.com.
Oh,
so
really?
I had to put that dash in there.
Oh, there you go. I don't have that problem. There's no one with Natalie Gruninger out there, apart from me, I don't think. Anyway, I've got that one now.
Now you're going to have to check because
there
might
be. Well, I do have that one, but I don't. Yeah, maybe there is another Natalie Gruninger running Tudor history. I'm not sure.
There could be.
I will add that link. So don't worry, everyone, if you didn't get it right there, I'll add it to the show notes to make it nice and easy for you to click on that and visit Adrienne's website and find out more about her books and her work. And I haven't read your novels yet, but I am so excited to read them. They're on my list and I'm going to do that. So I can't wait.
Oh, I hope you enjoy them.
I'm sure I will. I'm intrigued by all of this. Absolutely. Now it is time to play our little game of 10 to go. Are you ready?
I am.
Excellent. So what are two items that are on your bucket list?
Oh, I want to go and lay a wreath at the site of the sinking of Titanic.
Oh, that would be so amazing. Yeah, that would be really amazing. And it would be a good time for us to plug Gareth Russell's new book, I think. Don't you think, Adrienne?
Absolutely. Yes,
I can't remember the title, though, unfortunately. Amazing. Do you know the title? Because I've just completely slipped my mind.
So in the U.S., it's going to be called The Ship of Dreams.
Oh, I like that.
And in the U.K., it's called The Darksome Bounds of a Failing World.
Wow, you are so good. That was excellent remembering of those titles. And I've said to Gareth that I'm very much looking forward to reading them because apart from the Tudors, I am just a kind of general history fan. And the Titanic era and that particular event has always just fired up my imagination. So I think that's another one to add to the TBR list, definitely.
Yeah, well, we've talked about it quite a bit, and I was so lucky to get to read, his manuscript.
Fantastic.
So I can tell you that it is amazing.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
And you'll love it. It's really great. I can't wait for it to come out.
Oh, how exciting. All right. So, sorry, laying a wreath is one of your things?
Yes. Gosh, and I don't know. Oh, I know. I want to go to Norway and Denmark, which Ooh. Is where my paternal family is from.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Yes, I really want to go there too. Maybe we can go together, Adrienne, and we can see the Northern Lights together. That's on my bucket list.
Let's do it.
That sounds good. All right. What do you do to recharge?
I read. Yeah. I read constantly. Every day I read a little bit. And I always, like, right before I go to bed, I go to bed like an hour early and I just, I get in a nice full hour of reading and it just makes me feel, you know, like I forget anything that caused me stress during the day, anything that I'm anxious about. I get just that 1 hour to kind of disconnect and it definitely helps me.
Yeah, it is so important. And I think it really helps have a good night's sleep as well, doesn't it? When you do a bit of reading rather than staring at the screen at night, which, we're all guilty of at some point, but that doesn't really, not conducive to a good sleep, I don't think. So on that topic, what are you currently reading?
So I am reading Graven with Diamonds.
Ooh,
which is
about
Thomas Wyatt.
I love that book. I have read that one and I really, really recommend that one as well.
Yeah, it's really, really good. And I was in the doctor's office when I read the part where she thinks that, you know, perhaps Thomas Wyatt may have given some evidence against Anne when he was in the tower. And I was like, what?
I know. Oh, gosh. That is I did read it some years ago and it's fantastic. Yeah, it's so different. Yeah. Like I find the angle that, really unique.
It is. Yeah.
All right. Great. So another one to add to the list. describe your ideal Saturday night.
Oh, my goodness. Staying home with my husband and son, watching, a good movie or playing video games. we love to play the Lego games, the Lego Harry Potter.
Yeah.
It's kind of a nice little fun. We have fun. Family fun doing that.
That's so good. So important to have fun. And you mentioned your son. I've got, my son's almost 11. And he is a huge fan of Star Trek Voyager. I don't know if you've watched any Star Trek Voyager, Adrienne.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he loves it. He's completely obsessed with it. He just watches all the series and starts again. And often I'll just sit down with him and watch, just to hang out with him. And it's because I actually find it a really good show. I love Captain Janeway, by the way. And
she's amazing.
She is amazing. Such a powerful woman. I love it. And I often get so, like, when I'm watching the episodes and I watch them in their transporter room and energizing from place to place, I often think, oh, imagine how amazing that would be. So imagine we've got the transporter room and that you can actually energize anywhere. You can go anywhere instantaneously. Right now, you could jump in there. Where would you go?
Oh my goodness. Well, if I was in modern, staying in modern day, I would go back to England, and I would go back to Hever Castle, and stay there again. We stayed there this fall, and it was just amazing. And so I would love to do that. If we were going into the past, I would want to go to Anne Boleyn's coronation.
Oh, me too. I would love. There are so many events I'd love to see in Tudor times, like the Field of Cloth of Gold, for example, because I think we would see we would see everyone basically there.
Yeah.
But the coronation would be, what a moment, what a triumphal moment that would be for all of us, you know, Anne fans out there.
Yes.
All right, good. Yeah, and Hever Castle, so beautiful. I've had the pleasure of visiting it several times. And I know you were recently there with some other Tudor people. Is that right?
Yeah. I was there with Sandra Vizzoli.
Yeah, that's so, right.
And then James Peacock from the Anne Boleyn Society.
Exactly. I heard the wonderful time that you all had. That's so great.
Yes, it was. It was really amazing afterwards when we were all sitting at the Henry VIII pub sharing our stories. And we actually, Sandra and I, went to an evensong service at the church where Thomas Boleyn is buried.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
And it was so amazing to sit in there and just imagine what it would have been like.
Absolutely.
You know.
When I went there, I spent so much time just kind of wandering around, just thinking, oh my God, picturing, you know, little George, little Mary, little Anne there, because there was no, as far as we know, no chapel inside Hever. So the family probably would have worshipped there. And isn't it amazing just picturing them sit? And it's quite small, so it's kind of a cozy atmosphere. And it really is kind of mind-blowing, the connection you can make there. And listeners, I have spoken to Sandy about her work surrounding Anne's letter, that she believed Anne wrote a letter from the tower during her imprisonment. So if you haven't listened to that, please go on and listen to that episode, because that's really amazing as well. And I will be speaking to James in a future episode. So there you go. I've got everything covered. All right.
We're all interconnected.
It's such a beautiful Tudor family. Like that is what I love. I've been doing this now 10 years, this online sort of Tudor community, and I have made absolutely amazing, amazing friends, dear friends that I love, and met so many incredible, talented, you know, people. It continues to blow my mind daily, actually, the connections and people reaching out and supporting each other. I really do think that's what it's about.
Yes, absolutely. Totally agree.
All right. Let me see where I was up to there. I lost my spot. So what is, maybe, let's see if you're willing to share, what is one of your guilty pleasures?
Oh my gosh. I get a coffee from Starbucks every morning before I go to work.
That's not too bad. That's all right. A cup of coffee. I think there's lots of people out there.
My guilty pleasure is getting a Starbucks coffee every morning before I go to work. And I used to feel really bad about it. But then I thought, you know what? There are so few things that like really can truly give you pleasure that aren't that expensive.
Exactly.
And, you know, so that's mine.
that's not bad. Definitely not bad. So what is something that you love about where you live?
Oh my gosh. I love the fact I live right in the perfect spot in my state where within an hour I can go to the city, I can go to the beach, I can go to the woods, I can go to the mountains, I can go to the desert. I mean, it's just such a perfect central spot. All of those things are available in my state, and I love it.
That sounds fantastic. I love that. That sounds really, really good. Now, what was the last movie you watched?
Actually, it was Can You Ever Forgive Me, which Melissa McCarthy is in, and she got nominated for an Oscar for it. And it's really interesting. It's about a woman who forged historical letters.
Oh, that sounds really fascinating. I'm embarrassed to say I haven't even heard of it. I'm so in my bubble, in my history bubble, that honestly, sometimes I actually have no idea what's going on. In terms of like films and, you know, contemporary books and stuff, I feel a bit silly. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about, but I can tell you about things that occurred 500 years ago, if you like.
Usually, I am the same way. The movie I watched before that was Mary, Queen of Scots.
Yes, me too.
But I, you know, it got a lot of buzz during the Oscars. And mm-hmm. I thought, you know, that's actually kind of interesting because, you know, could you imagine if somebody was out there? Well, and actually there is people who forge Tudor documents.
Exactly. Or have. We've just spoken about that. So that sounds interesting. I actually would like to see that. Yeah. So I'm going to add that to my list. Adrian, what was your first paid job?
My first paid job was working at a Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Oh, lovely. I worked at a McDonald's. So
you kind of have to. It's like a rite of passage.
It is, I think. Yeah. Lucky last. Let me see. If you could swap places with one person, they can be living or dead, doesn't matter, for a day, who would it be?
Oh my gosh. Actually, I would swap places with Henry VIII.
Oh.
On the day of Anne Boleyn's execution. Aww. And I would commute her sentence.
Yes, good. I really love that. I'm going to support you in that. I'll swap places with somebody close to him and be like, yes, you can do that, Your Majesty. That is what you need to do.
Yes, I'll be Henry and you can be Suffolk.
Yeah, there you go. That sounds good. Now, I really enjoyed that. Thank you. I love the 10 to go. I always have so much fun there. It's time for your tutor takeaway, Adrian. So something for us to explore, check out, read, watch after the episode. Do you have a tutor takeaway for us?
Well, I have two.
Yay.
So if you are in the UK or are able to go to the UK, I would really suggest going to visit Gray's Court, mm-hmm. which was the home of Catherine and Francis Knowles. Go visit. It's beautiful. They are so welcoming. The garden is gorgeous. And just down the road is St. Nicholas Church, mm-hmm. which is where the Knowles monument is.
Okay.
And it is beautiful. And that was on my bucket list. We saw it when I visited this fall, and it was lovely. The highlight. Yeah, it was amazing. But obviously, not everybody can get over there.
Sad. Until we have our transporter machine up and running, right. That is.
Yes. So I wanted to suggest something that you wouldn't even have to leave your house for.
Oh, goody. Okay.
Yeah, so if you go, which I'm sure you're totally familiar with, but there is a website called archive.org.
Yes.
And you can find amazing resources on there. And one of the things that's on there is mm-hmm. the privy purse expenses of Mary I.
Yes, yeah.
And it's such, even if, you know, I know that sometimes Mary is kind of a controversial figure.
Yes.
So even if you're not super interested in Mary's, you know, and in her, it just serves as a really great snapshot of Tudor life. You know, the things that she ate, she loved strawberries and cream, you know, the names of the people who came to visit her, what the people came and asked for when, you know, they came to kind of curry her favor. It's really an incredible kind of snapshot of the things that were going on in a Tudor household. And so,
that's a fantastic suggestion. I love privy purse expenses, and I'm just so sad that they haven't survived for every year of the Tudor reign, which I really want them to. Yeah. You know, that they do offer, as you say, a snapshot, and I think they allow us to make quite a good kind of personal and emotional connection with the person, which goes beyond those kind of big events. They're about the everyday and the quieter moments. So I love it. Everyone go and check out the Privy Purse Expenses, and I will put a link to it from the show notes so that it's nice and easy. Adrian, this has been so wonderful. I could continue talking to you all day, but I'm sure you have things to attend to in your life, apart from chatting with me.
No, not at all.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking to Tudors. Yeah. Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you, Natalie.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon. Thank you.